I'm going to speak in English. Where is the wisdom we lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we lost in information? Now, these words of T.S. Eliot have inspired me in deciding in the first place to present a paper under this title, Scientia versus Sapientia, and to deal with the question of the importance of wisdom in scientific research. It is becoming more and more common in our culture, particularly in the West, to confuse three concepts which were kept, at least in the pre-Enlightenment world, clearly distinct from each other, and yet interacting with each other, namely knowledge, information, and wisdom. Now, in this paper, we shall look at the relation between these concepts, their specific meaning, and their implications for the relation between science and ethics, which is the subject of the conference this afternoon. I have a longish part on the history of the notion of wisdom, but I am going to summarize it because I realize that the time is pressing. What is important for us, I think, in this conference is that in classical Greek thought, wisdom was playing a central role in epistemology and in philosophy, and I would say also in life. Among the classical Greeks, the word sophia, wisdom, signified one of the principal four virtues, arete, along with justice, moderation, and courage, and occupied a central place, as I said, in epistemology itself. What do they mean by wisdom? Well, Socrates thought that wisdom is a part of kind of knowledge, but not any kind of knowledge. It's the knowledge which provides the basis for good judgment in decisions pertinent to how one should live. And in the Republic, Plato envisages a class of rulers who, though through their extensive training in mathematics and dialectics, will come to know the idea of good and thus make infallible judgments as to which political decisions would be just. Scientific knowledge would thus be identical with judgment leading to the good. This is, I think, the definition of wisdom in the classical Greek thought. Aristotle slightly modifies this, but I will not deal with that because I hasten to come to the main part of my subject, of my paper. I will briefly say that the important and noteworthy thing is that there has been, in the course of history, what Gabriel Marcel called le déclin de la sagesse, the decline of science. In the Judeo-Christian world, we still have the word and plays a very central role for example, in the Old Testament, with books which are called sapiential books, have as their central theme Sophia. This interest in Sophia continues with the patristic period, with the medieval period, and then it suddenly disappears. No one, really no one, uses the term or discusses this term either in philosophy or in science in modern times. This in itself is a remarkable development. Now, I will, having noted that, I will simply raise the question of what would it mean today if science or if philosophy were to recover this notion of wisdom. What would this mean? And I put this in the form of the following questions. First question that I would raise, I repeat, if wisdom were to be recovered by science. Can wisdom put limits to scientific knowledge? To many scientists today, it would be totally unacceptable even to put this question. With the emancipation of human reason by the Enlightenment, any obstacle to human knowledge and scientific research would amount to bringing us back to the Dark Ages. Now, this apotheosis of knowledge and human reason has resulted in the loss of two fundamental aspects or dimensions of human existence, namely, the sense of mystery and the idea of the sacred. Gabriel Marcel, in the book that I mentioned, writes, "There is no doubt that we think of the wise man as a reasonable man. But is the word reasonable altogether unambiguous? I do not think so. The reasonable man is perhaps fundamentally and above all else a man who perceives the limitations of reason. It is mystery that keeps the human mind healthy. So long as you have mystery, you have sanity. Reason, in a reasonable man, acts, as it were, as its own brake, and where this brake is lacking, there can be no room for wisdom." Unquote. The action, therefore, that there is no limit to reason and no bound to scientific knowledge is meant to exalt reason, but in fact, it deprives it of its most fundamental right, namely to control itself. The true scientist knows that the unknown, not only what he does not know yet, but what he will never know, is greater than what he will ever know through science. Humility is not an ethical, but an epistemological condition of true science. Thus, it is reason itself that dictates wisdom as the self-control of knowledge. There are mysteries which reason itself chooses to leave outside of its control. This is what, in the pre-Enlightenment period, was called the sacred. The sacred is the area which is devoted to God, that is, to someone or something which man leaves out of the control of his reason. Before the Enlightenment, this area remained undefined or defined by the church or other religious factors. And this led to conflicts between religion and science, and the result has been to reject the sacred altogether in scientific knowledge. This exilement of the sacred from scientific research has meant that the scientist is free to enter into the mysteries of life, to investigate or even put under his control even the mystery of life itself, producing living beings or altering and modifying them as he likes. That this attitude can lead the human being to self-destruction makes it obvious that it is not a wise choice. But having exiled the sacred, by what means can the human being protect itself from its own reason? It is only reason that is left to turn knowledge into wisdom. Only what is wise is reasonable. Or is the reverse? Is it the reverse? Only what is reasonable is wise. Poor man, he is caught up in a vicious circle. The axiom that there are no limits to human knowledge cannot coexist with wisdom. An ethic that would be based solely on what is reasonable, which is only what is left to us after the exile of the sacred, has now undertaken the task of reconciling knowledge with wisdom. Will it succeed? The second question is, can wisdom affect scientific method? I have already referred to the need for a holistic method, or I haven't, it wasn't part that I omitted, a holistic method in science. The division of scientific research into specialities has resulted from the understanding of human reason as the master of nature. This attitude to nature lies in the very roots of modern science. Descartes claimed that the development of science would make the human beings maître et possesseur de la nature, while Francis Bacon, in an almost brutal way, invites humanity to treat nature as its slave, and Kant assigns to humanity the role of a judge whose function is to exercise rational and moral judgment on nature, directing it in accordance with what the human being considers to be right or wrong, good or bad for it. Now, this attitude to nature has turned it into an object, which has to be analyzed, that is nature, an object, which has to be analyzed into its components in order to be more easily and effectively comprehended and thus controlled by the human mind. Science itself is becoming more and more aware of the problems created by both objectification and analysis in scientific method. Quantum physics, for example, has put into question the objectification of nature and scientific method by pointing out the influence of the researcher on his or her experiment with nature. At the same time, scientists realize that there is a widespread interaction and interdependence between the various elements and species in nature, so as to make it impossible to isolate them in scientific research. You cannot know the bee, for example, without studying at the same time the flowers on which its existence depends, etc. Wisdom, therefore, demands a departure from the attitude of dominating and controlling nature by the human reason, which has characterized modern science from its inception. This would benefit not only science, but also nature itself. Since science shares a great deal of responsibility for the ecological crisis of our time by being domineering over nature, both in its philosophy and in its method. Wisdom, therefore, would benefit not only science but also nature by taming the arrogance of human reason and making the human being respectful of the integrity of the object of scientific research. A third question: can wisdom affect technology? Technology, in the broad sense of the term, the logos about techne, was there in human life as soon as the Homo sapiens began to make tools. Yet it would be misleading to identify modern technology with the logos about techne, even in classical Greece. It is true that both Plato and Aristotle deliberated about the relationship between techne, the arts and crafts, and episteme, knowledge. For both of these philosophers, techne were activities involving the making of things in a way which was guided by the logos, the reason, and could thus be reasoned about and taught. Yet Greek techne is a long way from modern ideas of technology. The modern sense of technology appears for the first time in the 18th century, when in the work of Johann Beckermann, it is presented as, I quote, a functional description of the process of production, unquote. Thus, unlike what the Greeks thought of techne and logos, in modern times, the concept of reason and speech, logos, was extended deeper into the fabrication process. In modern technology, it is not only the ends and form of artifacts that are amenable to the logos, as was the case in ancient Greece, but the very process of manufacturing itself. Now, the important thing about this process is that nature has to undergo an acute intervention of human reason involving a decontextualization of the raw materials out of their natural contexts and a reduction of them to primary qualities such as bitterness, homogeneity, etc. In this case, the Homo faber no longer cooperates with matter, but acts on it, imposing himself and interfering with the most fundamental and ontologically constitutive structure of the natural elements that make it up. Martin Heidegger, in his 1954 essay on the question concerning technology, looks deeper into the nature of modern technology by describing it as Gestell. He calls it a challenging of nature to be unlocked, transformed, stored, distributed, and used. This, Heidegger observes, creates a technological system into which the human being is itself inframed. The forester who turns a tree into cellulose is made subordinate to the orderability of cellulose, which for itself is challenged forth by the need for paper, which is then delivered to newspapers and illustrated magazines, he says. Human beings thus challenge nature, but in the end cannot control it, as they become themselves part of the technological system. As Jacques Ellul, in his book, The Technological Society, puts it, unlike the technology of ancient Greece and even the pre-modern world in general, in which techne were located in the context of a non-technical matrix, incorporating ideas of beauty, justice, and contemplation, Everything is now construed in technical terms. We see that even in music, not to speak of medical and other sciences, so that there is no non-technical context to which technology is subordinate. Technology becomes, in this way, self-directing, a self-determining phenomenon. Given this situation, any hope for wisdom to affect technology would be unrealistic. Technology, in its modern sense, just described, does not allow for any modification or adjustment that would make it more humane and respectful of the sovereignty of human freedom or of the integrity of nature modern technology, therefore, seems, in my view, to be in its very nature resistant to the influence of wisdom. Finally, I raise the question of knowledge in relation to information. This evaluation will presuppose a certain purpose set by the knower. If one's purpose in knowledge is, for example, related to astronomy, any data about the function of the heart would be rejected as irrelevant to the purpose set by the knower. In addition to that, for the data to become knowledge, it would be necessary to refer them to other data so that a meaning and an identification may emerge. This is this and not that. These conditions constitute the minimum requirement in order to establish certain identities, that is, to know someone or something as an existent or a being. To these may be added qualities of value, aesthetic, economic, etc., which would require further eclectic evaluation according to the knower's beliefs, cultural values, etc. Thus, while information provides objective and necessary data, knowledge is the result of a process in which human freedom and cultural or community values play a decisive role. This applies to all forms of knowledge, including, I think, the scientific. Now, the problem with the domination of information over knowledge, or the hypertrophy of the former, owing to the hegemony of technology, is that the human being is forced to receive more information than it can absorb or evaluate critically, so that true knowledge may emerge. This appears to be the case in our days. Owing to the spread of the computer and the internet, and their increasing use in education, people receive more information than they can actually absorb and critically evaluate. This inevitably results into a diminution of people's ability to critically evaluate things, the data offered to them, with all the consequences that this may have for their lives. Modern man, having grown suspicious and fearful of the mythological and the unreal, and having identified truth with reality, has given has given to data full priority and authority, particularly in science. Unlike the arts, which may be allowed or even expected to operate with the mythological and the unreal, science is supposed to base its knowledge on data. It would be therefore unwise to expect scientific knowledge to abandon the use of information as a sort of raw material for its work. And yet, having said this, we must draw attention to the dangers for culture as a whole, and even for science itself, involved in the hypertrophy of information as a substitute for critical evaluation and community values. Even science needs imagination and, of course, critical evaluation of the information used in its work, and certainly cannot operate in a cultural vacuum devoid of values. And now, by way of conclusion, our look at history has shown that the idea of wisdom, which was so central in classical Greek thought and continued to be so also in later tradition, declined rapidly in modern times, particularly after the Enlightenment. Knowledge is no longer controlled or guided by what is good. And just, but develops and operates independently of any values, resisting any demands for self-discipline and moderation. T.S. Eliot is right. We have indeed lost wisdom in knowledge and knowledge in information. Science and ethics seem to have lost the interdependence provided for them by wisdom. In any discussion, therefore, of the relation between science and ethics, as is the present one, the recovery of the idea of wisdom is of crucial importance. Science is called to take into consideration in its work what is beneficial and what may be harmful for humanity and indeed for creation as a whole. It must cease to believe that knowledge in itself is the highest value in life, and recover the lost sense of the sacred and the mysterious in existence. Only by recovering wisdom, science will cease to provide dangerous threats and be a blessing for humanity and the natural world. Thank you.